This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
How can we know the time of crisis has arrived?
The signs are all around us. You know what I'm talking about.
You don't know what's going on. You've been away for far too long. You can't come back.
As our first guest, Ellen LeConte, says right on the book cover, why so much is going wrong everywhere at once and how life teaches us to fix it. This is a wise woman with new rules, life rules. After that, and out of an army of trouble facing us, we'll go again to the big one, the developing shift in our climate. Right now, the Arctic sea ice has retreated again as we warm the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels. And yet those same oil companies causing the Arctic melt are pushing into the newly exposed waters. What happens when their wells off the cold coast of Greenland blow, like the BP Deep Horizon did in the Gulf of Mexico? Greenpeace has a ship watching over, activists storming the rig in a last-ditch effort to bring our attention to this Arctic oil rush. We'll talk with Vicky Wyatt, climate campaigner for Greenpeace International. And then we'll end up with new research. All the news, this whole media circus, is all about us humans, our faces, our lives, our world. What is happening to the rest of living things as the climate heats up? How do animals and insects tolerate the heat? We'll talk to the investigators, two scientists, with the first clues. 1 hour, three interviews, one goal. Welcome to all our new listeners on stations across North America and around the world. This is Radio EcoShock. Right here on Radio EcoShock, you get news on the converging crisis of our times. We face dangerous weather, changed climate, higher prices for energy and food, plus maybe a double helping of worry about our economy, the value of money, even the government. Our guest, Ellen LeConte, says we have hit critical mass, a kind of buildup that could lead to social explosion or maybe some sort of collapse unless we make some big changes. The title of her book says it all, Life Rules, Why So Much Is Going Wrong Everywhere at Once and How Life Teaches Us to Fix It. Ellen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you on both.
Ellen, this is a great time to talk with you. I've been looking forward to it because a lot of us are struggling to see that big picture that you work on. Early in your book, Life Rules, you introduce the idea of critical mass. Can we start with that? What do you mean?
Yes, we've hit a point unprecedented, actually, in human experience at which a number of forces are bearing down on us or converging all at the same time in such a way as we can't separate them out from each other. We in our own minds and our politicians and leaders tend to think of the problem of climate change or of energy prices and shortages or of food prices or of unemployment and of the whole host of reduced social services, all the things we're currently experiencing. They tend to think of them as being separate and to be handled and treated separately. But that's not really the case. If you dig down and find out what the underlying cause of most of these problems is, you realize that they're all sort of joined at the hip and it is now a critical mass, a point at which, if we persist, everything that we're accustomed to, life as we know it, will change dramatically without our being able to do anything about it.
So we have this serious swirl of problems, and we've been raised to believe our institutions will find solutions. But the bankers and the dictators, the billionaires, the big government, they're stalling. They seem to be making it worse. So, Ellen, you seem to be saying something else is really in charge of events. Who or what makes the rules?
Well, in fact, we like to think at this point, because we are dependent on this globalized economy, we like to think economists do, and that somehow they'll figure out how to heal and restart and grow this global economy that supplies us with pretty nearly everything we need to live and the things that we like to have but don't really need. In fact, what they've missed, and most of us have missed, is that every kind of economy, every size of human economy on this planet is dependent on the largest economy it's part of. And the global economy, the global human economy, is not actually the largest economy on this planet. The largest economy, the largest supplier of goods and services, is actually the biosphere, life itself. And if life, living systems on this planet change dramatically, no human economy can function as it ever has before.
So when you talk about life, you often put a capital on it. Are you picturing a kind of living force like Gaia, or do you mean the scientific description, which might be the totality of biology acting within the laws of physics? What do you mean by life?
I would say both. I would say Gaia is a name, a goddess, a Greek goddess name that was given to that totality of living systems on this planet, on this finite planet, and I capitalize it in the book in order to separate it from just our human lives, from human life. We tend to favor human life over the larger community of life forms on the planet, and sometimes putting a capital on something makes it stand out in our minds differently. We are, as one species, part of that larger capital L life community, and we are dependent on its health and well-being for our own.
And in your book, you took the risky step of comparing our developing troubles to AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. I wondered whether that was going to work, but it seems to. Why did you pick that model of disease, and what can we learn from it?
Well, historically, and now speaking of the history of the whole planet, of living systems, of life itself, as well as of human history, up until the beginning of the industrial era, human communities and natural communities worked on the planet in sync with each other and with the resources and ecosystem services that were provided by living systems. They worked together. And what has happened is that this global economic system, which knows no limits and operates as if it could grow perpetually, runs up against life's rule, which is on a finite planet, no system can grow perpetually. What has occurred as a result of that is that human and natural communities, as they have been, as it were, taken over, diseased by this global economy, are no longer able to protect, defend, and heal themselves as they once were. This is exactly what happens when HIV enters the human body. It undermines the immune system, its ability to heal, to protect, heal, and take care of itself, and these natural and human communities, our natural and human communities, are no longer able to do that. The comparison does hold up extraordinarily well. I was pretty surprised by that myself.
So is there some way that we can work on restoring our immune systems?
The same way that living systems have. Interestingly, life began about 3.9, just about 4 billion years ago on Earth, and it began with single-celled bacteria-like, and in fact, bacteria, microbial living things. For the first 2 billion years, that's all there was on Earth. And bacteria, those microbial tiny little beings, managed three times in the first 2 billion years of life on Earth to globalize and almost put themselves out of business. They created an energy crisis, a climate crisis, and a pollution crisis, much as we're doing. And then somehow life, or this totality of little living things with no brains, learned how to stop doing that. And life built in after that a sort of code, genetic code, if you like, of ways of surviving without living unsustainably, to create economies that would work sustainably on this planet. We can learn from how life did that.
If you are just tuning in, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Ellen LeConte, author of Life Rules, Why So Much Is Going Wrong Everywhere at Once, and How Life Teaches Us to Fix It. Ellen, in the spring of 2011, we saw uprisings in North Africa and the Middle East. There have been public protests in Europe, especially in Greece and the UK. But it seems no matter how bad unemployment gets in the United States, or all the tornadoes and storms and the families foreclosed, the benefits being cut, I just don't see much organized public resistance in America so far. Why not?
Largely because although if you read along the lines that I do, and I suspect many of your listeners do, if you read about complex systems and read about the environment and care about those things and read about how any economy is dependent on the natural environment that it's working within, if you understand those things, then you can see what's why a global economy no longer works. Americans have been out of touch, except for attending their national parks, going to their national parks on occasion. Americans, most Americans, are out of touch with the natural world and have no training in or exposure to the idea of complex systems or living systems or our dependence on them. And our leaders are quite happy keeping us in that place of ignorance. And so long as we're in that place of ignorance, we can continue to believe in that American dream of perpetual growth and universal prosperity and cling to it almost like children clinging to a parent they hope will treat them well forever and take care of them forever.
Well, before we get into the way life teaches us to respond, I'd like to wrap up on the question of why so much seems to be happening at once. I can hardly keep track of the jaw-dropping news. How about you? There's just huge developments. Do you see this as a temporary stage?
Well, temporary only in the sense, it's what I call the end of cheap easy. We're at the end of cheap easy fossil fuels, cheap easy water, cheap easy food, cheap easy minerals and metals, all the things that have allowed us to populate the planet as densely as we have, and for some of us to live as well as we have, are about to come into permanent scarcity, unreliability. And that means we simply won't have the things that we're used to work with any longer. And because all of these are occurring, our consumption levels or degradation levels of all of these materials and systems are coming at about the same time. They are converging, these crises, and you hit a point where we simply have, we're living beyond Earth's means. And that's the first time in human history that the entire planet is now at risk of our overshooting what it can provide us with.
So we can see some big storms on the horizon. Ellen LeConte, you suggest there are five ways humanity can save itself. Big media is always telling us to want more, but you say we need to downsize. Tell us about that, please.
Well, one of the things that living systems, those ancient bacteria learned without computers or benefit of brains or any kind of political organization was that one way to survive on a finite planet was to create economies, establish economies that were place-based, that depended on, learned to live within the limits of what was available locally. Living systems, sometimes they get gifts of clouds of dust or rain from elsewhere. I mean, rain travels around the planet. But for the most part, living systems, natural communities, can't import. So downsized economies for bacteria and for humans would learn to live with what they have available to them locally. Every economy would be, every local and regional economy would be based on what was available to it or could be made available without harming the living systems that that economy depends on.
I really like the green economy section in your book, Life Rules. Our impact on the planet obviously isn't just fossil fuels. It's everything we strip out of the earth. You know, I can picture where even in North America, people will go through the dumps at one point to find the metals and the plastics for reuse. I hope they do.
That's right.
But shouldn't things be designed to break down into other useful products or at least some useful raw materials right from the start? Could we do that?
Yes, we could. And there are people that are, there are companies, there's a book many of your people will know called Biomimicry by Janine Benyus, written, I think it's probably almost 10 years ago now. Scientists, innovators, technicians are looking at ways of mimicking the way life makes things and the way life recycles things. And most of what we need to know to be able to change our ways of providing ourselves from a way that is consuming the planet and putting all life, including ours, at risk, most of the information, the teachers, teachings, technologies, tools, most of them already exist.
And we've got to stop putting more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, but we all have to admit our addiction to fossil fuels is very strong. We take it for granted we'll drive down the road to get some more food or something. It's built into every aspect of our daily life. How can we begin to deal with that?
When I began researching and writing this book several years ago, I still imagined that we might decide to do that soon enough, My guess is, although I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, my guess is that until we really start to feel the pinch in terms of prices and unpredictability of, for example, electricity, the price of gasoline, the canceling of airplane flight, until these things in North America hit home, we probably won't really do anything about it. It's clear, certainly here in the U.S., the Congress and the administration, every Congress and administration has failed to deal with these issues. They're not so easy to deal with locally, although it is possible to relocalize energy systems as well. But it means you have to stop thinking your energy systems are going to take you around the world or bring you food from around the world. They become as local and downsized as the rest of your economy.
And you conclude the way we organize socially could determine whether we survive. Are you suggesting democracy is or could be a natural system?
Interestingly, when I was doing the research for this, I was looking for ways to understand how to talk about how natural communities organize themselves, because clearly humans don't organize an ecosystem. All those diverse, very diverse, multi-sized living things, other than human living things, organize these systems that work so well. And one of the central characteristics, and I'm not the first person to say this, there are a number of writings out there that validated my instinct when it came. Natural systems, natural communities, ecosystems tend to be what I call organically democratic. They organize from the ground up, they collaborate, they use resources equitably, relatively equitably. They speak to each other in ways that we're just beginning to learn the secrets of in chemical codes, genetic codes, and behaviors that allow them to work together, despite how different they are, to communicate across their differences in order to create systems that are sustainable over thousands and thousands of years.
Yes, what you've just said kind of took me into the forest and the way the tree roots communicate with each other between trees chemically, but also with fungi that they
exactly
need to survive. It's all working there together with a lot of signaling systems that we don't really know much about yet.
And just knowing that that's the way it works without yet having to know exactly how it works is a guide for us in terms of organizing. Most of the decisions that will need to be made as critical mass worsens and as governments continue to fail to make the decisions and policies that we need them to make, we will at some point, humans will, Americans, Canadians, North Americans will realize, hey, we could do this better ourselves than they're doing it or not doing it for us. And then you begin to really tackle the issues that are important to you, providing food, protecting water supplies, cleaning the air, creating alternative transportation systems. All of these things can be done on a local and regional level when people realize they have to start working together for provisions instead of working alone for cash.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock with Ellen LeConte. Alan, so many people I talk to realize globalization needs to fail to save the ecosphere, maybe to save us from extinction. How do we deal with that? We're dependent on it, and yet we feel that it must go down and something new must come.
The encouraging thing, although as is the case when any overlarge system collapse, there are losses, and among those losses are losses of life. One of the things we bring to that potentially as humans is a kind of caring and humanity which makes whatever the horrors are that are coming, less horrible. But we also, as a species, have a way, we've done this for 2 million years, of rising to the occasion. When there is an occasion we know we need to rise to, and when its nature has become clear to us. If we do not proactively make these choices, and the system collapses, the economic system, which pretty much brings down the political systems with it if it fails, then we will begin to do what we need to do because we'll know we need to.
Do you find women talk differently about the future than men do?
Yes. Although, interestingly, a lot of the support for this book and this work has actually come from men and from older men, and I'm not sure why that's the case. But I think the whole focus on life and living things and caring and feeding and supporting, these are things which even now more often fall to women than they do to men. In third world countries, it's usually the women who come to understand these issues before their men do. and begin, well, I think of Wangari Maathai, who organized the tree planting in Kenya, which turned into a whole green belt movement and gave whole communities, villages, neighborhoods, and cities in Kenya the opportunity to organize themselves to support themselves when their government wouldn't do it. It's Vandana Shiva in India. Many of the leaders in the work that we're talking about that needs to be done are women.
And a lot of women lead in the ecology movement as well.
Absolutely. Many of my colleagues, supporters, people with whom I am exchanging support, one book for another, conference speaking, recommending, critiquing, many of the people with whom I'm doing that are, not surprisingly, women.
All right. Well, you know, we followed some similar tracks, Ellen. I see you were a writer and a homesteader in New England, and you got to know Scott and Helen Nearing, the homesteading couple who inspired so many people. Maybe we should back up a little bit for the younger crowd. Who were the Nearings?
They were what were called back in the 20th century, which already seems, you know, a very long time ago. They were in the middle part and toward all the way almost to the end of the 20th century, what were called 20th century pioneers. In the Great Depression, Scott, who was a professor of economics, and Helen, who was a violinist, a concert violinist, and the spiritual teacher J. Jiddu Krishnamurti's first girlfriend, which is an interesting sidelight. But Helen and Scott met. She was 20 years his junior. He was ready to retire from the world that was disappointing him economically during the Depression and wanted to be no part of child labor and other activities that were trying to bring us out of that Great Depression. Helen and Scott retreated from New York to Vermont and took up a sustainable lifestyle, and then very cleverly in the late 40s began to write about it and wrote a series of books called the Living the Good Life series, which actually Living the Good Life, the first book, has been in print, I think, for 60 years now. And it was sort of a Bible for the Back to the Land movement in the 60s and 70s. So the Nearings work, and they there's a Good Life Center I helped to set up in Maine at their last forest farm in Maine, where people go to learn some of the techniques of homesteading, organic gardening, and some communitarian activities as well.
And you wrote two books about the Nearings. Can you tell us the titles so people can follow up?
Yes, I don't know whether there are many of them, many copies even available now. One was called On Light Alone. Helen, toward the end of her life, she was a very spiritual woman, Buddhist theosophy influenced, and she spoke at the end of her life of wishing she could live on light alone, like the flowers and the vegetables in her garden. That one talks about the end of Helen's life and her good death. And the other, Free Radical, was about Scott's end of life. And both of them were as committed to a good death as they were to a good life, which is why I wrote the two with issues of aging and dying as part of the conversation.
And Scott lived to be what, 100?
He was 100. He died at home 3 weeks after his 100th birthday. He was determined to hit that post at the end of his life, and he did very quietly in a Chaise Lounge, and then in a cot in at home with Helen and other good friends by his side. He quietly went to sleep, and his kind of end-of-life teaching, do the best you can in the place where you are and be kind, stands the test of time pretty well, I think.
You bet. I'm going to write that down. You know, you also have some interesting articles popping up in your archives at ellenleconte.com. What's going on there? What are you putting in there?
These will be pieces, some of which will be sort of a life rules blog. I've got an environmental novel that I almost got sold a few years back that didn't quite make it, that I'm uploading. But they'll mostly be pieces about what people are doing to deal with these problems, the crises that we're facing, ways of thinking about them that are fresh ways of thinking. My writing, others writing along those lines, and a continual sort of update of the way things are getting worse even faster than I expected that they would, along the lines of things that are no longer cheap and easy for us.
And do you have a new book in the works as well?
I'm going to start, I think, with the pocket version of this book, something that can be carried around and easy for people to digest, which will have sort of a translation of Life's Rules for Economic Survival, which are detailed in the current book, Life Rules. But I think those can be broken out as a sort of 10 commandments of living sustainably, and that'll be called the Little Book of Life's Rules.
Ellen, is there anything else you'd like to add as we wrap up?
Only that I think I am amazed always by human resilience and our capacity to love each other through difficult times and find ways to survive them and learn from them. And I still believe that that's difficult as this time ahead may be. That will be what comes out the other side, will be our ability to rise to the occasion.
Yes, we may even find our hearts grow larger with more difficult times.
It happens always, mostly in difficult times.
Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex Smith with Ellen LaConte. We've been peeking into her book, Life Rules, Why So Much Is Going Wrong Everywhere at Once and How Life Teaches Us to Fix It. Find out more at ellenlaconte.com. And that last name is spelled LaConte. Thank you so much for sharing with us, Ellen.
Thank you so much for asking such thoughtful questions, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, saying thank you for listening. How could it happen? The sea ice has barely exposed the fragile Arctic Sea, and the very industry responsible for the big melt is already rushing into the iceberg-laden waters. It's another risky move for the oil addicts that rule the world these days. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Greenpeace climate campaigner Vicky Wyatt. Welcome, Vicky.
Hello there.
Despite some brave action by Greenpeace, which we want to hear about in just a few minutes, I'm betting most North Americans just don't know about this early oil rush into Arctic waters by an energy company based in Scotland. Vicky, can you give us an introduction? Who are the players and what are the stakes?
Well, Cairn Energy is a small oil company based in Scotland, and they made their money in India. And in the last few years, they've turned their sights to the Arctic and the oil that lays beneath the ice there. And Greenpeace are really concerned because Cairn Energy are leading the way into the Arctic, and other oil companies such as Shell and BP are really watching what they're up to. And they're a very, very small company, and they don't really have any experience, as nobody does, of drilling in this very remote and cold and icy location. And Greenpeace are first and foremost really worried that if a similar spill to that happened in the Gulf of Mexico happened in the Arctic, there is absolutely no way that Cairn would be able to contain and clean up the spill. And that would have a devastating impact on the Arctic. And as we know, it's home to species such as polar bears and narwhals and lots of other species that don't live anywhere else on the Earth.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with more from Greenpeace climate campaigner Vicky Wyatt as we confront the dangerous new oil drilling in the Arctic. They don't call it Iceberg Alley for nothing. EcoShock.org for all our free MP3 downloads. EcoShock.info for the show blog. I'm Alex Smith. Stay tuned.